All right, so now we can get to the meat of the issue. We have Chad and I assume Kate here. And Chad, isn't it funny? I can't remember what we were going to do. What were we going to talk about? An important topic. Sure you remember.
William Irwin Thompson, climactic literary masterpiece.
Finnegan's Wake issue. The Finnegan's Wake issue, right. Okay, so Ginny, you can be part of this. You've looked at Finnegan's Wake. Is there anything you want to say about the testimonies, Ginny, before we move on?
I just want Chad to bookmark them in his brain, so if he wants to extrapolate any good information. I think I sent them to you, Chad, but if I didn't, did I send them to you?
Not all the ones you just read, no. But you can just get them off Facebook and Google Plus, is that right?
I'll just send them to you in case you want to use them in any of our stuff. Yep.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Right. Looking at, right, they just went to Carolyn. In Whirly Merwin Thompson's books, I have to look at my chart. Where's the chart? Oh, I can go to my own Facebook page. Had a very good week reading William Irwin Thompson's poetry over the last 15, 20 years. There's a collection, came out in 2009. And I can see why Ian says we end up in the Thompson Quadrant. I've got an inventory of so many quotes that apply to him trying to work out the very things that one tries to figure out when you're listening to Ian. Now, remember we played last week, August 30th, 2014, Kim found this section where Ian all of a sudden started talking about Thompson and said, we don't know where he comes from. We don't know where he, what he is, or where, how this guy happened. Well, that was last Saturday. So I'm reading this poetry, and I'll have to look at my inventory to find exactly where it is. I've got so many notes now.
Well, the one that I'm talking, the one that I brought up is part one. So it's like
one of the first copies
you made. Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at my own, not what I posted. These are my little typed-in notes of the poetry, of themes. So I've got several on his thing, so let's see what that is. Just a second. A second, still looking for it. Right, here it is. So I go to page 100. So I'm reading along after thinking about what Ian said about Thompson all week long, and you come to... quite far into the book, page 100, he has a poem called The Ancestors. And it starts off, how did you get in this family? And that's in quotes. It says, my mother asked, and then answered, you must be a changeling. So that's what he's talking about here. His parents, his mother especially, decided that they don't know where he came from themselves. It's a family issue. So this poem says, quote, how did you get in this family, unquote, my mother asked, and then answered, quote, you must be a changeling, unquote. A child, the fairies switched, sneaking me out in their dark traffic below stairs in the big house where chambermaids mounted by the Lord's randy sons were sent to neighborly estates, where milady's sickly infants dead in childbirth were switched at once by the wet nurse with the young maid's infant, spunked by milord's last spark. An undercover secret world where the older maids rocked the boys to sleep by stroking their small cocks. All this turned by the Irish mind into a myth of the fairies from under dolmen and stone ring, the Tuatha De Danann gods, reclaiming old Ireland before Milesian and Sassenach came across Lear's green white-flowered plain. Johanna Hurley, daughter of Lady Alice Dawson, Protestant, and Patrick Hurley, Catholic, an agent for the Dawson lands in Tipperary, Munster, sailed alone on the Manhattan with huddled masses of 400 from Queenstown bound for New York. Her mother's fall from grace could not grant her place on Dawson's estates. Born in 1849, just as the famine was dying off, that would be in Ireland, there was no hope for her except in a fairy world across the sea. On April 12, 1867, the Manhattan docked in New York, and the young girl made her own way to Chicago, where she met and wed Timothy Fahey, giving birth to John Thomas Fahey, who disowned his daughter for marrying Dad. So his own mother got disowned through these problems because the dad was a divorced man and Protestant. Then he says, listen to this. This was my covering story, complete with birth certificates, baptism records, and memories. Again, this was my covering story, complete with birth certificates, baptism records, and memories. Ireland was a metaphor for an erased pre-existence in some other fabled estate. As I aged, says Thompson, my cover faded, and my mother began to sense I was not who she thought I was. At the end of a certified life, meaning his own, I can see behind the stage set, arriving with the time I leave. So there he is. It's a poem about him discovering he's a weird dude. The very thing that I had said 2 years ago about him, and I am probably knowing we would get to this point, but that's pretty interesting that it's a family issue. So then you go to page 101, and he's trying to figure out some more stuff. He calls this poem the Mobius... No, sorry. That was... I did read 100 and 101. So, let's see. That's the main poem about his questioning is where he comes from. So, Chad, do you have anything to comment or Ginny about that?
Well, there's a lot of names that were in there from ancient Irish lore, because when I was over there, I learned about some of them. And from Angela, too. The Tutan Danu, they're the tribe of the gods.
Yeah.
And yeah. Angela seems to think that the Dan part of the name also links them to the tribe of Dan in the
right.
tribes of Israel.
Yeah, that's Herbert W. Armstrong stuff, the 10 Lost Tribes. And, you know, mm-hmm. Denmark is the tribe of Dan, so to speak. They do a lot on the D-A-N. All mm-hmm. right, and then Milesian and Sassenach. Do they mean anything to you?
Sassenach? Is it spelled phonetically or does it look different?
Yeah, S-A-S-E-N-A-C-H.
I think that means English, an English person. It's a derogatory term by Scots and Irish.
Yeah, and Milesians may be... another culture. And they came across Lears, I guess that's Ireland, green, white-flowered flame.
Like L-Y-R-E?
L-I-R. L-I-R. So, what the previous lines is about how the lords of these, you know, feudal estates birthed a lot of children from the maids in that. And, then they had to hide them or cover it up. And so they're saying one of them was sickly, so the wet nurse switched that. So I guess Bill is looking at maybe he was switched. He may not be looking at it as dramatically as Ian is, but he does say, I can see behind the stage set arriving with the time I leave, arriving with the time. Now, he does all these incredible statements about time throughout his poetry. And cosmic awareness.
But why does he think that he was born in Ireland if he was born in Chicago?
Oh, no, he was born, the family came, oh, wait a minute, that's a good point. Right, yeah, he was born in Chicago and then he moved to California when he was young. So it's all about the myth of the family. Now he thinks that he may not be Irish, or that was a metaphor. For an erase.
No, there's all that Irish lore that the little people would come and switch babies at birth and take a human baby and leave a fae.
So he is trying to explain why the parents don't think he's a member of them.
And how many people, including our foster daughters, say, I don't think I'm, you know, I think I'm alien. I think I come from another world. Everybody who looks at the ridiculousness of the earth thinks that they're above it. Everybody with a brain, I should say.
So he's making a big deal out of the cover-up story, complete with birth certificates, baptism records, and memories.
Yeah, he's just trying to create a story about why he feels special and different.
Well, I think it's more than that, and that's what Ian said. And I think he's, why would he end with this odd statement? I can see behind the stage set, arriving with the time I leave. Now, we'll read a whole bunch.
And Ian, yeah, he said that when we portal, we can go somewhere and spend a whole lifetime and come back before we even left.
Right. So he makes statements like that that you can put the Ionic knowledge mm-hmm. into it. Mm-hmm. So we look at what he says about time. Many times he brings up time, and I was just saying that cosmic awareness said my amulet or talisman, I can't remember which it was time and eternity, the symbol for time and eternity. So I've been thinking about last week or two about how the deep ascended realization of Iondom talk is how there is no time. And you really have to move into the irrational to show that you understand that. Because if there's no time, then ridiculous things can happen to you. Like Moses, showing up here today. When there's no time, when you really get into it, you can't even do physics. You can't even do duration. You can't have a sense of, well, I was here, and then something happened over the next 30 seconds and went there. That's time. Doesn't work. So he doesn't fully get that, but he's conceptually sort of working towards it. So we'll go to page 27 and see what he first says about time. He said, the story of a shared body. Carolyn sneezed. Okay. This is a poem about Apuleius, who was a Menippean satirist, and how he could have thought all the things that happened over the next 2,000 years, over the last 2,000 years, all the different thinkers, they all made sort of evolutions in creating what he calls the slow articulation of the Christian self. And but if Apuleius had thought all these things at the very beginning, we would have been further along faster. But he says near the end, the story of a shared body, the ass and I guess he means the Logos, the donkey that Jesus came into Jerusalem on in its final days. The story of a shared body, the ass and I, is the story of the body we all share. For those of us who bother to take time for stories, art is the unhomicidal religion in which we look back and laugh, initiates in the mysteries of Isis, which in plain English is repeated once twice and once for the art of memory. So, I am, that's just the beginning of this interesting statement. Oh, is that right, Ginny? Is it, do you hear that? Hear the cracking?
I hear it.
Okay, so has it stopped?
No, it's still there.
Well, you talk, Karen, see if you get it.
Oh, that's better.
Okay. I'm not going to read the whole poem that leads into that thought, but that's an opening statement. The story of a shared body, the ass and I, is the story of the body we all share. For those of us who bother to take time for stories, art is the unhomicidal religion in which we look back and laugh, initiates in the mysteries of Isis, which in plain English is repeated, once for life and once for the art of memory. Okay. Next page, 32. He says, time is not open to the cycles beyond history. Well, I'll read a little bit before that. He's talking about the Fisher King and the diamond. And he says, the pubic triangle pierced by the lance. shows that Percival is the double of the maimed Fisher King, a reflection in which ego confronts its own diamond, or historical time confronts the stars. I guess the stars mean eternity, Carolyn. So the ego confronts its own diamond, or historical time confronts the stars. Between ego and diamond, and that's D-A-I-M-O-N, is the soul, the maiden who bears the moon's silver dish. But Percival does not ask the question, whom does the grail serve? Time is not open to the cycles beyond history, and wars become the only world we know. Then he says, you see, now I had to get he and his wife, his new wife, out of London and take us back to Stonehenge. The Celtic line from Wales to Brittany could bardically inspire Christian de Troyes to receive and write what he could not know. Stonehenge was the last of the stone circles, where the Cretan volcanic explosion filled the skies with ash, and for 18 years there was neither spring nor summer, nor light of sun, moon, and stars. The land was truly a dark wasteland then. Then he says, the order of Siculus, some guy, lived within the closed sea inside the classical script of capture. The alphabetical mind, brings in a little McLuhanism, the alphabetical mind, Phoenician traders brought to ancient Greece. So they brought the alphabetical mind. The alphabetical mind, Phoenician traders brought to ancient Greece. The listeners to the aged Homer wrote him down, unknowing they were shifting the mind from ear to eye, from resonant sound to objects separating in space. Then it says, the Hyperborean sage Abaris is said to have flown once on an arrow to ancient Greece to see Pythagoras and pass on his knowledge before it sank below the closed horizons of the world. That would be the closing of the effect of the phonetic alphabet. Across Scotland, Abaris's Platonic solids are carved handheld rocks, images for initiates of the hyperspace crystals and clear blue toroidal or torus, toroidal spheres that turning in friction with three space can generate angelic knowledge through words in human time. Polyphonic words turn to hyperspheres. Joyce in his final work, Finnegan's Wake, and Dylan Thomas in his, quote, Altar Wise by Owl Light sonnets, tried to be in words the time-faceted rocks of Scarabrae, S-K-A-R-A-B-R-A-E. These Celtic bards, Joyce and Thomas, drunk or mad, were the last of literature as wizard's art. So that was the last of literature before you had your airport novels. Okay, Carol, you get that? So that's 32, 33. So then you go to page 40, and he says, this thing is called ancestral lines and lattices. In the pagan Ulster cycle, you can see in the pillow talk of King Ailill and his queen Maeve that she's the archaic figure of a lost matriarchal world. I mark how two prehistoric cultures there claim authority. The wild Kurgan and settled village swirled together like the two doughs baked into Jewish marble rye. The open sexuality of the still powerful women contends with the loud, crude displays of bragging men in wickered halls who try to contain them but can't, and so seek to trade them around like little boys with baseball cards. Then he names a couple. In Diarmuid and Granny's Pursuit in the Irish Fenian cycle, and in, quote, How Colic Won Olwen, unquote, in the Welsh Mabinogion, you can make out the Celtic myth in the folktale of the old king, the beautiful wife or daughter, and the daring upstart lover. The sun's archetypal contest of spirits and inhuman time. The sun's archetypal contest of spirits and inhuman time, in old winter and green young spring. From Diarmuid and Granny, the bards moved on to Tristan and Iso, that's the couple on the first page of Finnegan's Wake, where the cuckolded old King Mark comes straight out of Irish myth into this new age medium of the written page and story. So this new phenomenon of writing and eventually print, he's calling a new age medium of the written page and story. Now, you know, a lot of New Agers try to retrieve the effect of visual space. Then he says, in Gottfried von Strasberg's version for a non-Celtic audience, that would be a version, I guess, of Tristan and Isolde's story, on the other side of the Rhine, it's the feudal bond between men that really matters to him most. Young Tristan is the perfect knight, slayer of dragons, evil kings, and hideous hairy giants. The sin here is not adultery, but breaking the feudal bond between a vassal and his lord. For so perfect a Christian knight is Tristan with his sword and harp, and he takes up most of the story, the broken oath does not make sense and takes an outside mechanism, the magically elixired flask that contains the Irish potion, the mini-trank that can dissolve the whole feudal system of men for the love of just one woman. Through the mother's lore of plants, prehistoric Irish witchcraft from the edge of the world, the ancient powers of women recall a time when kings and sons were not what life was all about in the great goddess villages. Only a woman's witchery with Paleolithic magic and Neolithic herbs and plants could make so great a Christian knight betray his uncle and his king. Like the Vedic Ramayana, this is not a story of love, but of men and manly values. In this new art narrative, traded across Western Europe from Ireland to Germany, time itself now begins to tell a story of free human souls. In 1150, Beruul requires a magic love potion to explain the lost couple's fate. The chemistry of tragic love is women's secret trickery. Whether Fata or Fortuna, fate is an uncaring woman, indifferent or in contempt of a knight's acts of bravery or a scholar's sense of justice. But three generations later, the death of King Arthur needs no magic love potion to explain Lancelot's adulterous love for King Arthur's Queen Guinevere. After the Crusaders return, having heard Arab songs and heard of Persian tales sung over Ouds, Persian tales sung over Udes, U-D-E-S, and then he names two couples, Wis and Raymond and Layla and Majnun. Moroccan Ouds become remade into new lutes for troubadours. Out of a war, a love breaks out of the warrior's old control. New cults and heretic visions, inspired by Islamic Sufis, Cathars, and Balkan Bogomils, turn prehistoric Celtic sex and churchly Christian marriage into medieval courtly love. From the blue flute-playing Krishna and the jasmine-bosomed Radha, to harp-playing Tristan and Iso, poetry across Eurasia carries songs of forbidden love. Medieval individuals in personal lives of desire rediscover what Sappho knew, an age before St. Augustine in sunlit blue Aegean Greece. Behind the aged Cornish king is the Celtic god of winter. Behind the Persian king Maubad lurks a Manichaean era of pre-Islamic Gnostic lore. Light and dark, the two brothers are Gnostic archons from ancient myth. King Maubad is an echoed image. An Ahrimanic, that means Antichrist, an Ahrimanic demiurge who traps the soul's light in matter, is the king who still holds down the female soul in the dark time of a patriarchal marriage. Just as the king is an archon in the Persian story of Wis and Raymond, so in Tolstoy's Russian story, Karenin is the Count Vronsky. When the soul begins to recall its last year in Marienbad, which is a famous movie in the 60s, maybe a French director, René, I think. When the soul begins to recall its last year in Marienbad, then Orpheus becomes much more than a statue in the garden that gives René's cult film away. Here the husband is an archon who tries to keep the woman trapped in a ring of definitions and the deceptions of the world. Madame Bovary, a famous novel by Flaubert in the 19th century. Madame Bovary may have been bored numb with her dullard husband and unable to stop herself. But Dr. Zhivago's women express the double life of the soul. With agape, he loves his wife, but with eros, he finds the soul he had before his life began. There's that. He finds the soul he had before his life began. Then history gets in the way. In the Russian Revolution, the folk soul becomes the collective as it was once in Ice Age times. The lion man of Vogelherd and the sorcerer of Trafair, this caveman art, reveal a time of shaman souls entranced in small group minds and states of half-animal possession. Caught between her two men, Anna crossed herself on two railway tracks, and that is a geometry of parallel unmeeting lines where lovers meet infinity. In dreams, each night the freed soul roams out of a physical body. Now you talk about astral projection, or maybe even more. In dreams, each night the freed soul roams out of a physical body. It can cheat on its spouse while both are squarely in the container of the home and conjugal bed. Soul has its own morality and can thoughtlessly discover the true consequences of thought, as it will once again in death. There is no solution to this old conflict of body and soul. If you still the volatile soul in some pure Buddhist nirvana, you give up all that life's about. That's what Ayan says about the suppressing of your mind and body in Buddhist meditation. If you still the volatile soul in some pure Buddhist nirvana, you give up all that life's about. Small wonder the Buddha had no use for women or his wife and child, or that Catholic priests and nuns find sex gets in their way to God. The root in Latin for the word adultery is ad alterum, and means to add on another. Now, he then listens to what he says. He suddenly starts saying, add a point to another point, and you can generate a line. Displace one line from another, and you can generate a square. Pull a second square from the first in open separating space, and you can generate a cube. Shock the cube orthogonally into the unseen fourth dimension, and you create the tesseract. In my case, I still see in frames of my remorse four real women shift in the unstable cubes of memory slant narrative tesseract of reflection. Do that again. In my case, I still see in frames of my remorse four real women shift in the unstable cubes of memory slant narrative tesseract of reflection. So if you look at the tesseract in Wiki, you'll see it's squares flipping in and out of larger squares. So he's saying that geometry is a metaphor for the relationships he had with four different women. And that's a poem called Astral Lines and Lattices. And I note that under time. He's talking about time there somehow. So we go to page 50. And he says, he talks about visiting James Joyce's grave and statue in Zurich. So he says, it's called The End of the Line. First you take the number 5 tram at Fallonplatz, this is in Zurich, where James Joyce would go to cafe-restaurant Fallon more often than the Odeon. The Kunsthaus is across the street. Then from Fallonplatz to Fluntern, you change to the 6 for the zoo. You go on to the end of the line, you can't miss the cemetery. It's the first thing as you get out. The way to Joyce's grave is marked. You'll see him sitting by his grave because his statue looks just like my father. I kept coming back. Thompson lives in Zurich occasionally for many years. Once pouring out Irish whiskey, so Thompson himself poured out Irish whiskey onto the Joyce grave for June 16th. That's Bloom's Day. And he goes, Whiskaba, the water of life, in pouring into the dirt strange attractor. So after you've paid your respects to himself with John Jameson, that's a drink, be sure it's not orange old Bushmills, another drink. Start with the dust of shattered stars, that river run beyond Adam. There's shockwave currents rippling out from hypernovas and black holes, faint hawking cold radiation. Then let the dust settle in space, a droning bass of brains, that would be the brains that Ian talks about occasionally, B-R-A-N-E-S, P-brains or something? A droning bass of brains and strings, string theory, below a massless spatial warmth. So he's talking about the river run beyond Adam with the shockwave currents rippling out from hypernovas, black holes, settled dust below a massless spatial warmth. Then wait till gravity strikes a match with mass as the gases thicken. Wait till gravity strikes a match with mass as the gases thicken and set the cluttered dust on fire, turning a star into our sun. I'm told there was war in heaven, the turning spokes of solar light hardening in tightened orbits to crashing planets and hurled moons. Theia, T-H-E-I-A, Theia knocked out a third of Earth that became our shielding moon. A rib for Eve after Lilith scared the pants off foreskinned Adam. So the moon is a rib for Eve after Lilith scared the pants off foreskinned Adam. That's a story from godless tribes too dumb for Isis or Gaia. Our blue-eyed great goddess women, Maeve, Grainy, Skaltic, and Emer, terrified the ordered Romans and turned them into braying priests. Where was I? Oh, yes, near the end of the Holocene with my scotch. Are you saying, where was I? There's another way he's saying it, because the Holocene is the geological era we're in now. And this is when Thompson says we're going to have the die-off in the Holocene period. So he goes, where was I? Oh, yes, near the end of the Holocene with my scotch. From the supernova back home to the unstable crust down here, dying is what goes after life when gods fade out from too much light. Compassion does not come easy to a sphere without a facet. It takes a crack to catch the light in turbulent dark reflection. That's why we keep coming back. The smooth laminar flow of God stopped, folding into human time, as we willingly are pulled down into the painful bright delights of a thought-exhausting body. Catastrophic errors attract souls looking for a chance to be embodied in dark tragedies. For absent-minded landlord gods, so he's describing the fall, what motivates it. Catastrophic errors attract souls looking for a chance to be embodied in dark tragedies. For absent-minded landlord gods. Wait, I gotta read that right. Catastrophic errors attract souls looking for a chance to be embodied in dark tragedies. For absent-minded landlord gods have forgotten love's sweet sorrow that Joyce sang to his Molly Bloom. The vividness of smell and taste in the act of mammalian sex redounds with Molly's dirty words and Joyce and Nora's coupled mind. And then there's death, like husking corn, pulling the flesh violently away from the soul's entanglement. You know how you rip off the corn, Carol? The husking part? That is death pulling the flesh violently away from the soul's entanglement. Once we're in, why is it so hard to let go? That could be being born. I'm not sure which way that goes. And then there's death, like husking corn, pulling the flesh violently away from the soul. I guess you pull the flesh away from the soul, and that's reincarnation. Once we're in, why is it so hard to let go and be gods again? We pay for the fond delights of sex with the stink of old age and death. Remember, Ian says aging is very hard to do? So, the stink of old age and death comes from the fond delights of sex. That's how we pay for the sex, apparently. But sometimes we die together in a great event you can see from above is the mind body of some single archangelic being embracing it as art. So this whole phenomenon, the angel is embracing it as an art form. Read that again. But sometimes we die together in a great event you can see from above is the mind body of some single archangelic being embracing it as art. Then he names some earlier geological eras. He says the Permian and Cretaceous are now about to be followed by the Holocene extinction. That's our time right now. This planet has long suffered life. From galactic catastrophe to planetary extinctions, life seeds itself from forest fires and holds the dark in thermal vents. But arias of love and death become tragically all the same. Purcell, Verdi, and Puccini. Is it love or just time and sex? So he's linking time with sex there. For me, it seems a bit too much. I could vote for a universe more comfortable and Swiss, not this American TV. I guess there is this other plane, two or three levels higher up, where one irons out differences and violence is constructive. That's the view of Ion, non-physical. You know, differences and violence are constructive. You know how he celebrates anything that we do? Are you listening, Carol?
Yeah.
So then he says, after your grave meditation... he meditated looking at Joyce. You sit there and meditate while looking at the James Joyce statue. You walk to the Zurich Hotel and have a drink with the whole view of Zurich, the lake, and the Alps. There's nothing like it in Dublin, not even the famed Wicklow Gap. And he says, lots of fun at Finnegan's Wake. It, too, is the end of the line. Then he has some German or something, I don't know what it means. Alle aussteigen aus dem Zug, als die Endzeit ist Gott entzugt. Then he says, describing Finnegan's Wake, chimerical, comic epic with the Irish voice of a poem and shape of an English novel. This work of Zurich and Paris tracks the individual's end. There's Hesiod and Homer at the beginning. Hesiodic and Homeric, it finishes literature. It's capital F-I-N-N-I-S-H-E-S, almost implies Finland. Hesiodic and Homeric, it finishes literature. Talking about Finnegan's Wake. But blind Homer and purblind Joyce, he was pretty blind himself, start with Troy and end the story of a civilization in a pub. All the voices are of the dead passing ghosts through the dreamer's mind in a dark bed undercurrent. Where English is the liquid stream of all language, it is. No, where English is the liquid stream of all languages, it is. Sung in a Dublin Irish brogue, not in pitch hexameters or Anglo-Saxon stress blank verse, but the ultimate poetic run-on line. So he's describing Finney's Wake as a run-on line, running on river to living and dead full-filled sea. River and sea, person and place, flow into one vast biosphere. Joyce foreshadowed ecology, his skilled accompaniment to Vernadsky's Gaian science. Now, Vernadsky is the early scientist who comes up with the idea of the noosphere before Teilhard de Chardin, and LaRouche makes a big deal out of Vernadsky. So here's Thompson bringing in a LaRouche character. Joyce foreshadowed ecology, his skilled accompaniment to Vernadsky's Gaian science. River and sea, person and place. The individual mind melts into a bacterial film. First came myth and stories of gods, then folklore songs for lightning work. But then the art got on its high horse, and the warrior's epic boasted of men in arms and noble blood. Next came trade and more middling men with stories of sex and money. The Miller's Tale to Molly Bloom. That would be Chaucer, I think, The Miller's Tale, 1300. Then to 1900, Molly Bloom. Now novels are mechanically reproduced by famous authors, TV scripts without the pictures. That's what he's saying novels are today. Inanna and Olivia, Riverine and River Run, The Age of Civilizations, 3112 BC or BCE to 2012 AD. The ancient Mayan calendar marking the wave of human time, the pulse of civilization with its punctuating dark age. The Elementals, The elementals who live on the hot planet ignored by us now come into their space in time. And the sidemen volcanoes say, the last one out puts out the light. See, the last volcano is going to put all the light out, Carol. Just like that. 18 years of no sun. The last one out, says the volcanoes, puts out the light. Then Thompson goes autobiographical. I was born in the Depression and can remember FDR and looking for Hiroshima. With my new nun-drilled reading skills, he was educated by nuns, on my knees. So he's looking at a map to figure out where Hiroshima is. With his new nun-drilled reading skills, on my knees before a large map spread out on the living room floor in our flat in hot Chicago. From the line of the novel's plot, Lazarillo to HCE, HCE, a character in Finney's Wake, the bottom or poetic line. So from the line of the novel's plot, Lazarillo to HCE, you have the bottom or poetic line. We all end up in time's red ink. So red ink is debt, right, Carol? We all end up in time's red ink, written in the volcanic sky and literature's last campfire. So I'll sit, drinking in the Alps on the still sunlit Zurichburg, checking my Swiss Eterna watch. Some kind of modern watch. These dark ages must come and go, but after the ashen skies clear, another mind will form in which elementals and men learn how to get along with the gods without the need for evil. Perhaps next time in that new world, two suns will be better than one. Now, Ian talks about the two suns in The Event, the TV show The Event. So there's an Ionic theme there. So that's up to page 54. And let's just check in to see how the... I'm not going to say what you are, but there's two more anonymouses. Anonymous, unplugged. Anybody's got anything to say about what you're hearing so far?
Interesting to hear his tour, Zurich, Bob.
That's where you are, right, Bert?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's about, I don't know what time of the year he's in Zurich, but you could bump into him someday. Maybe you've already seen him. He describes, I could look up at some point, he describes walking along
Bob?
Zurich streets. Yes.
Didn't he live there for like 14 years or something like that?
He lives there on and off all the time since the early 80s, you know, for 30 years, because his wife's a kindergarten, his second wife is a kindergarten teacher there, and she hangs out there, and he comes here and does his classes or lectures or writing and then goes back and forth. So yeah, let's see if he lives. Yeah, Zurich is part of his home. But he's itinerant. I mean, the book is called, the book of three long poems called Still Travels. It's like saying, where's Bill? Oh, he still travels. That's something his wife might have said to some, to Bert in his store. Bert didn't know that he was talking to Thompson's wife. And Thompson and Bert says, who's that guy? He's walking up down the street here with his groceries. I've seen that guy, but then he's not here for 6 months. Then he's here. And then she said, her name is Beatrice. She says to Bert, he still travels. So that's the name. That's the name of the book of poems. Still Travels. Or it can be still. Being still, you are traveling. When you're still in meditation, which Thompson's all for, he's been doing yoga since he was 15, pissed off that he hasn't gotten any big breakthroughs. He writes about that in his poetry. He's trying to parallel world all the time, and he writes about that. So he's still and hoping to travel. Still travels. So in his very first poem, listen to this. Under the low, enclosing, continuous, canned, tin gray clouds of a quiet winter, you get that all the time, right, Bert? The tin gray clouds of a quiet winter in Zurich?
Yes.
Under the low, enclosing, continuous, canned, tin gray clouds of a quiet winter, in an afternoon like any other, in practical, unecstatic Zurich, no ecstasy going on there, Bert. Very careful or cautious, I guess. He says, I walk. So he's walking under this typical weekday, you know, afternoon with the dull clouds. I walk, carrying my groceries back from St. Anahof, A-N-N-A-H-O-F. You know where that is?
Yes, St. Anahof. Yeah. Yes, that's, I know exactly where it is. Not far from where I work.
Yeah, it could be street. Is it Street Anahof or St. Anahof? Like, how do they write their street? They put the S-T?
St. Hof, it's St. Odehof. It's a little small place not far from the main shopping center in downtown Zurich. It's right in the middle.
Right, right, but what does the ST stand for? For street or for saint?
Straße.
So they put the word street first.
Yes.
They shorten it. So he's going along Anahof Street to...
Some street.
What?
He says Saint... What's the name again? St. Anahof?
Yeah, A-N-N-H-O-F. It's Anahof, A-N-N, which is a street. But he's got S-T in front. You could read that as saint, but it doesn't mean saint. It means street, right? Anahof Street. So he's carrying his groceries back from Anahof Street to the Oberdorf, O-B-E-R-D-O-R-F. Where's that?
That's just that's the over village. It's like the over part of Zurich. What he's talking about.
Older
it's like
part.
A little, yeah.
This is the center part of Zurich?
Yes.
Right, and St. Anahof Street, Anahof Street is near the Oberdorf. So then he says, yes. As I start to cross the Münsterbrücke, so a Münster Bridge, is that near Oberdorf?
Yes, it is. It's the old part of Zurich. It's St. Anahof. S-T is Saint. When he says St. Anahof, yes. St. Anahof, yes.
Now, you're like 10 miles from there, where you live?
Where I live is about 40 minutes.
From this downtown Zurich. Right.
Yes.
That's in normal traffic in a car?
Yes.
Slow-moving traffic congestion, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, it is.
Now... How long have you been here? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? How long have you been listening?
I've been listening for the last half hour.
Well,
but I've only been here like 10 minutes.
What?
I've only been here 10 minutes online, but I've been listening for a half hour.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it's so great that you show up, and as we're doing this, as we can, this is his opening poetry. So he says, as I start to cross the Münsterbrook, when was the last time you did that, Bert? 2 years ago? 3 weeks ago? Do you drive across it?
No, it's the Münsterbrook is a street that you can drive from the main central of Zurich into like the old town part. It's the bridge where you can drive over, but then there are other bridges that you can walk over. But the Münsterbrook is a small little bridge that you can drive across. It's one way each.
Can you walk on it? He's walking on it.
You can walk on it. Yes.
Okay, so he's walking home. He talks about this. He goes and, you know, gets his groceries and walks home. And he ponders the environment there. And he says, as I start to cross the Munster Brook, a suddenness of unexpected light stops me like a signal changing to red. Just above my line of vision, the crown of Charlemagne in his cathedral niche. You know that church?
What's the name of the church again?
It doesn't say at this point. Maybe a little later. Is Munster someplace with a church?
Yeah, it's a really large church. It's the largest church in Zurich. He's right in the central where you can see the Lake of Zurich. Because when he described the Lake of Zurich, there's a little park where you can sit and you can see the Lake of Zurich and you can see the Alps from where
okay.
And you can see almost the part of the city as well.
Yeah, I mentioned that. Was that on this? What was that? 50? The Joyce. Do you know where James Joyce's cemetery is?
That I don't know, but the bar that you mentioned earlier is where Sue and I had dinner, or we had drinks there. There's a special bar. It's called the James Joyce Bar.
Is
not
that
far
the,
from St. Anahole.
Is it the Cafe Restaurant Fowen, or the Odeon, no. Or the Kunsthaus? These are names, he says. Fowenplatz to Fluntern. That's the rail, the tram, but that's not the name of the... But I said the name of the restaurant somewhere in there?
Yes. Yes. And it's a bar right next to it, and it's called the James Joyce Bar.
Oh, okay. Well, what's it next
to? It's not far from St. Anahole. It's not far from St. Anahole.
Yeah, but you're saying there's the James Joyce Bar. What is it next to? Something that he named? Another thing that he
yes.
named?
Yes.
The Cafe Restaurant Fowen? Fauen?
Yes. Yes.
That's the one.
It's right around the corner.
Ate.
It's right around the corner. Yes.
You ate in James Joyce's bar, which was near Cafe Restaurant Fowen, what you're saying.
Yes, that's correct, yes.
And do you know the Kunsthaus, which is across the street?
Yes.
Okay.
They have several Kunsthaus in Zurich. Several.
All right. So you don't frequent these places very often, right?
No.
You're not downtown much, okay. So, but you know what this is. So he says, just above my line of vision, the crown of Charlemagne in his cathedral niche shines out gold in the low afternoon sun. So something's reflecting off the statue of Charlemagne. He says, I turn to track the breaking of the sky and see below the clouds, above the Alps, the sword of light that touches the king's crown, King Charlemagne, and the golden hilt of the sword he holds in rest and readiness across his knees. He doesn't look to the Parade de Platz, P-A-R-A-D-E Platz. You know where that is?
Parade Platz, yes.
Yeah. He doesn't look to there to note the battles of the Jews and Banks. Is that anti-Semitic there? He doesn't look to the Parade de Platz to note the battles of the Jews and Banks. He doesn't glare east to cheer on the Serbs. This is probably written right when the, you know, Croatian-Serbian crap was happening in the early 90s. So he doesn't glare east to cheer on the Serbs, hallucinating battles with the Turks. He looks intently to the south and west. Now that would be Los Angeles. And he goes precisely to the place where the sun sets, this undergoing of the evening lands. What can be out there but the furthest west, where Christendom ends and west becomes east, as the ocean falls off into the space between the earth and the boot-trampled moon. So he's asking, what can be out there? So what is he looking at? He's looking out, you know, far west. What can be out there but the furthest west where Christendom ends and west becomes east as the ocean falls off into the space between the earth and the boot-trampled moon? And he tells you where it is. Thompson says, I grew up there, driving along the edge, watching the sun set, waiting for the earth to crack and drop L.A. into the sea. So this is back in the 50s, Carol. You grew up in L.A., if you were mystically inclined and read that kind of literature, you're waiting for the earthquake to happen. So he spent his teens. And he says, now he's in Zurich imagining that, you know, Charlemagne is looking all the way to L.A. where the west turns into the east. And you have that line in Finnegan's Wake, where the west shall shake the east awake and the east shall have the night for morning. The mixing of Japan and America after World War II, where all the car factories moved to Japan and all the Japanese Zen Buddhism moves to California. So he'll talk about it later, but he's turning this into a poem. And he says, there, history is no cathedral. In L.A., there's no history, right? Their history is no cathedral, but an edifying day in Disneyland. Hollywood would improve on Charlemagne. In an epic film or TV special, they'd show him getting laid by the mistress of the Pope on the night before he's crowned. Well, old King, you know, the Hollywood version would be, yeah, he, you know, he goes around 800 A.D. to be recharged the Holy Roman Empire, and the Pope crowns him. So the drama would be, you know, Susan Sarandon would be a radical lesbian nun who is the mistress of the Pope and will fuck King Charlemagne, played by Burt. Because back then, the blacks were in charge. They ran everything in Africa. So Burt would play old King Charlemagne. They don't tell you about that, that King Charlemagne was a black guy. We know it here at the Black Caucus. We know who we were. So Burt gets laid, and then he gets a crown put on him. So then Thompson addresses Burt. He goes, well, old King, Christendom survived long enough to experience its decline and have its allotted 2,000 years cashed out in untragic banality. That was the fate of your kingdom, Burt. It survived long enough to experience its decline and have its allotted 2,000 years cashed out in untragic banality. Then he goes on to amazing. He goes on to an amazing story about the snake that comes to King Charlemagne. But I won't go into that. But that's the, so we know exactly where he must live downtown, or at some point when he was writing, lived down there, right? Because he's walking to the market. Let's see if he comes back to that and gives some more local details. Okay, then you go along. Now, do you know about Linden? What is this thing? He says, as I stood under the linden trees on top of the Lindenhof, that old Roman site of Turicum, T-U-R-I-C-U-M. Is that in Zurich?
Yes. It's a little park. It's actually a park not far from St. Anahof where you can go up and
see the same area.
That's where he described he saw the Alps and the Lake of Zurich. You can sit up there and you can see the whole Lake of Zurich.
So the Lindenhof is a Roman site, but it's a park. It's not a building.
Yes. No.
Okay, so in this poem about... Now, he goes on, have you ever heard of this famous Swiss poet, Walter von der Vogelweide, about 800 years ago? Walter von der Vogelweide. So, so he's meditating on the Lindenhof and thinking about this poet. No particulars there. All right, so he's sitting there, and two loud American tourists approach, spraying the air with English to keep the local foreigners from bugging them. So I guess they're trying to drown out the Swiss talk by loudly doing their English. And he says, they notice Thompson there writing in his journal. So two loud American tourists approach, spraying the air with English to keep the local foreigners from bugging them. They notice I'm writing in a journal. They sit down on the wall in front of me, turn to admire the recommended view, perhaps considering me as exotic as an old man with worry beads, sitting to the side in a Cretan taverna, T-A-V-E-R-N-A. That may be Crete? I'm not sure what a Cretan taverna. Maybe a Cretan pub. Pub in Crete. After a quick glance at the guidebook view, she tells her companion she needs a nap and sits down at the far end of my bench. There's room enough for her to stretch out, and her pushed breasts obligingly spill out in my direction. And then he says, take that, Walter, because he's addressing this famous Swiss poet. Take that, Walter. I'm under Den Linden, too late and too early. The two women move on. I take their place on the low stone wall with a better view. In the foehn cleared sky. Now, that's F-O-U-M-L-A-U-T-H-N. What's that? F-O-H-N. Is that someplace? In the foehn cleared sky.
Foehn. It's like a warm breeze. Foehn.
Okay.
Foehn. It's a warm breeze.
Okay. In the foam cleared, so the breeze cleared the sky. In the foam cleared sky, the still snow-clad Alps seem so much closer than they really are. A thin, stratus filament extends from the Dolder Spire, D-O-L-D-E-R, you know what church that is? The Dolder Spire, to the Munster Towers. So he's talking about the Munster.
Yes, there's two towers. Like, Munster is, it's a former convent, or like a, what do you say, cloister. It's a former convent, and then there's actually a large church not far away from it, with a large spire.
When I've just finished that part where he's talking about L.A. and Disneyland and the end of Christendom in untragic banality, the next section of the poem says, caught by the random re-coronation of the king, I begin to wonder what the icons all around me really mean. For the first time, I go into the church, the Grossmünster. That's what you're talking about, the big church, right?
Yes.
Church. He says, for the first time, I go into the church, the Grossmünster, I've passed every day without feeling a calling to go in. The Munster is not Chartres or Durham, I guess they're big cathedrals, where one feels the invisibles alive. Rather, it's a Reformation, sort of Protestant, it's a Reformation stripped down structure that's meant to keep you solidly in place, grounded, hard at work, confident enough to skip mystical transcendence. You notice that about your people there? They're not interested in the drops. They're not interested in ascension. They're just keeping their nose to the grindstone, hard at work, confident that the environment will never remind them of mystical transcendence. This is Zurich.
Yes.
Right? It's all very familiar to you.
it's like a scene in where he's describing when you walk. I go there in lunchtime. It's like a scene from The Matrix.
Really?
People just walking down the street. Yes, walking down the street and just oblivious to everything else.
And so you work near this area?
Yes. I keep walking distance, not far. Yeah.
Right. So he says, in the Middle Ages, the pointed spires went reaching up toward the celestial spheres. But when the guilds and trade mastered the town, they decided to split the difference between God and man and settle for less. Something Swiss, halfway between heaven and earth. So the spires were stubbed and rounded off in exchange for a life of pious wealth. Readings replaced magic, and ministers became bookkeepers holding the accounts. That's the religion ministers, church ministers. The great book, I guess that's the Bible, at the crossing, under glass, is on display, but I can hardly read its unilluminated Gothic script. So I turn and descend into the crypt. Have you ever gone into this church, the Grossmünster?
Yes. Was it 3 years ago when my aunt came to visit? We went and showed her that church. Yes, it's quite establishment.
Yeah, this is where the statue of Charlemagne is. He says there, you know, at this. So I turn and descend into the crypt. There, a weather-gouged and worn-out statue of Charlemagne shows me the other is a copy of a copy of the king. So the other one he was looking at is a copy, the one he did the first part of the poetry we were reading. I think that's what he means. Perhaps his propaganda, Disneyland and great moments with Mr. Lincoln, is not so far off the money as I thought. Patriotism's patriotism. Whether America or Vaterland. I tore the crypt like any tourist, then walked back up and quickly out the church. When I talk about the day's walk that night at dinner, my wife tells me when the kids in her kindergarten had an outing to the Munster, they sat down in the crypt to hear the old legend of Charlemagne and the snake and were completely enthralled. She tells me the story over the last of the dinner's wine in the candlelight above the empty plates. I understand what my searching eyes had been hungry for. So maybe it's read like this. She tells me the story over the last of the dinner's wine in the candlelight. Above the empty plates, I understand what my searching eyes have been hungry for. And then he goes into this fantastic story about the snake and what it does with the king. So that's your world there, Bert. Let me right to Bert's neighborhood where he hangs out, has his dumb sandwich at lunchtime, right? You have your little sandwich, your little wifey made this nice little drink, and you go and you fucking say, I wish I was in Maui and surfing right now. I got to do this fucking crap because I didn't read McClune or Roach or Thompson or Pynchon or Croker or anything, and I missed the boat, and all I do is meet Sue Bone. And Bob comes to Zurich, you know, Bob goes to Bern and doesn't even drop in to see me. What? Oh, woe is me. That's what Bert thinks about when he's eating there near, and then it's also intertwined. I start reading a book of poetry that I haven't read poetry in like 10 years, and I pull out, and it's describing Bert's neighborhood. How's that for synchronicity? Pretty neat. All right, so let's see if anybody has anything to say.
Yeah, it's very poetic and very nonlinear, and he's weaving together different scenes in a way that would sort of indicate parallel worlds are converging.
Yes, I'll read some of those, but the way those charts I posted on Facebook where he takes, you know, thousands of years and overlays the Atlantic, the arithmetic mentality, the geometric mentality, then the algebraic mentality, then the industrial mentality, and then our present chaos mentality. He writes his poetry that way. He's always overlaying what those charts show. You know what I mean? So he's walking along thinking of Charlemagne, then he'll start thinking of some geological phase when the women ran the societies, you know, the Cadel Hayek he writes about. So he's always overlaying, which is sort of a Kmart or Walmart version of fitting his wake, because Joyce is always doing that. So he's a true Joycean, but he adds in this whole mystical yoga, astro-projecting, parallel worlding element.
I was also thinking there's a bit of Ulysses in there, just the way that the town, you know, the sites in the town, the landmarks are laid out, and he's in a pub.
Yeah, he's comparing Zurich to Dublin, and he says one view was way better than the view in Dublin. At what was called the Wicklow Gap in Dublin. Yeah, he's always overlaying this. That's why when I started inventorying all the themes, I have time, birth and time, and I've got like 15 pages cited where he's talking about those themes in all these different poems, repeating them. And it comes down, he's a guy wrestling with what Ion's going to talk about. I'm going to read the poems where he's trying to reach his doppelganger. And, but just to go back to what we were doing, and anybody else can, I got all the lines open if anybody wants to say anything. Nobody wants to say anything? He talks about, by moving into this semi-trance state, he talks about getting into the hypnagogic state, and then into dreaming, and then into dreamless sleep, and he hopes to meet his doppelganger on the other side of the dreams or somewhere past the dreamless sleep. So he's always mentioning the word hypnagogic throughout his poetry. So he says, the gongorisma of the hypnagogic, this is page 65, and it's called The Waking Mind in New York. So he's basically writing about, what's he have at the beginning? These poems are written in Zurich, New York, and Cambridge, Massachusetts. And near MIT and Harvard. The gongorisma of the hypnagogic is Gans surreal, G-A-N-Z. More a painterly realm of Baroque disembodied bits than a public private nook where you can cop a feel off the girl of your dreams, gravity suspending tits. Whole parts come unstrung in epistemic titbits. He once said in one of his lectures that in the early 70s he had a bout of cosmic horniness, and that's probably what led to his divorce. Because another part of this book, he talks about the different women he had adulterous affairs with. So he's always talking about, you know, australopithecine men and reptiles and mammals and fairies and doppelgangers, and then he talks about some little girl's tits that he just saw walk along the street. So he's saying, the gongorisma of the hypnagogic is Gans surreal, more a painterly realm of Baroque disembodied bits, more that than a public private nook where you can cop a feel off the girl of your dreams, gravity suspending tits. Whole parts come unstrung in epistemic titbits. That may be he's referring to Foucault's episteme. Oh, by the way, I had two tremendous dialogues with de Kirchhoff, and probably another one coming up. Ooh. Really good, really funny. So you can look forward to new installments from the Kirchhoff world. Another guy stuck in Europe. Whole parts come unstrung in epistemic titbits. From the sheer power of concentration alone, you can will objects to stretch. So he's talking about what Ion says. You know, you can start making the environment respond to your will. From the sheer power of concentration alone, you can will objects to stretch until even your own cock fits satiric expectations in a carnival's auto-filleting thrill. flatting yourself. Compared to this Dali-like mind, my Mac computer, and he just says Mac, is still just a quill. So compared to his surrealistic mind, hypnagogic Gan surreal, my Mac is still just a pen, a quill. Then he says, deep, dreamless sleep is an imageless realm of sound. We know this without thinking when we say, did you have a sound sleep? If you think of it that way, did you have a sound sleep? Talk about the imageless realm of sound, deep, dreamless sleep. From dreams unbound, the mind sinks to depths where no phantoms play. Kalabai Yao, I don't know what that is, haven't looked it up yet. Kalabai Yao topologizes pulse and display. Read that again. Kalabai Yao topologies pulse and display shapes too subtle for anything the eye could trace. See, the eye can't track this. But with the mind stopped attention in the instant's delay, temporal realms of monads and strings of space can be heard on waking in the universe's droning ground bass. So he ends with a big note. Can be heard on waking in the universe's droning ground bass. Now we come to the next section. Doppelganger. So listen to this. So the title is Doppelganger. So he's gonna describe his attempt to contact his doppelganger. Begin then the journey at your feet. Let objects be for their objective sake. The bed, the chest, this meditation seat. Then he has an italics. Ah, but you cannot convert or make me attend your conscious pieties. You could a villain, but I'm a rake. Then he continues listing the objects. The altar, my bookshelf of deities. Terra, Fra Angelico's Mary and Dove. The Sufi heart, the Buddhist calligraphies. Then he addresses, I guess, the doppelganger in italics. Soon you'll preach about agape and love, but when you fall asleep, I'll slip out, and what you truly extend, I'll shove. Then he goes back to describing his meditation. If only my knees don't give out, for the numbing tetany, subtler than pain, but as effective a stop as a halting shout. Then back to him addressing something in italics. And what you truly stand, I'll shove in the cock. Unplug the stopped-up drain, embodying every pass-up thought to suck the semen from your yogic brain. Back to his mundane meditation. Begin with the breathing yogananda taught. So in his early 20s at university, he studied that guy who wrote Autobiography of a Yogi that the Beatles liked.
Yes.
Led them to the Maharishi Yogi. Now note this talking about breathing. We know Ayan says, watch out for that breathing. So he says, begin with the breathing Yogananda taught. And Bill did take courses from Yogananda. Yogananda had a ashram or something in L.A. that Bill walked by or traveled by, drove by all the time in his teens, but he never went in there. But then he met a guy at college at Cornell in upstate New York who turned him on to the Yogananda that Bill had witnessed for years. The exterior building. So he says, begin with the breathing Yogananda taught. Hung sa, I don't know what Chinese word, in softest astral inhalation until the stopped pulse is stilled thought. There's your still travels. Until the stopped pulse is stilled thought. Then he addresses the something, maybe the doppelganger. Well, all that air-conditioned ventilation is slower than simply falling asleep. You're pumping your image in a flat's inflation. I think he means an apartment. Then back to the pedestrian. A sudden wave of light, swift and steep, engulfs my field of perspectival sight. Remember, visual space, perspective. Engulfs my field of perspectival sight, but leaves no image, no icon to keep. Then he addresses the doppelganger. Clearly this will take him half the night, so I might as well go back in and doze, then watch the mind's wind toss his kite. And then he says, back to the mundane, a rich velvet of various indigos surrounds me in intimate purpled dark. A conference of birds, first doves, then crows. So then he says, the next section is titled, At the Edge of the Hypnagogic in Cambridge. So he's going back to another time when he's meditating, and he is trying to get or develop his astral projection. He talks about popping out of his body a lot, but it never goes where he wants to go. So he says, at the edge of the hypnagogic in Cambridge, the first stage, with eyes closed, you see the room you're in. Only you add elements of narrative from things you hear out the window from remembered persons who are not really there. In a doubled landscape, you image feelings of muscle inhibitors kicking in, transforming that feeling to floating up out of your body. Else you'd be in trouble. A sleepwalker with eyes open to deception. You dream you're floating, but you're not astral yet. And the landscape you see as you drift through the wall is all from memory. Instead of waking out, you wake up. Your neck hurts from bobbing up and down. You know, your head dropping as you fall asleep. You took the wrong right turn back to the waking mind. Now you will have to wait to mind another night. So then that's in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And now he attempts a game in New York. And this is called Within the Astral Wind in New York. In the astral, you feel the lift of the wind first as you snap out of your body. A spinnaker filling out, bound still to its yacht. You look down on your body, flat on a stomach in the dark bed. Something is pulling you somewhere. Be careful, the air is alive with indeterminate desires. Don't go off half-cocked on girlfriends, now squarely bedded down, more loved by their endurable husbands. So he's saying, don't go off spying on your girlfriend, former girlfriend, what they're doing with their husbands. He says, don't go off half-cocked on girlfriends, now squarely bedded down, more loved by their endurable husbands. You're still awake in the astral, able to make moral judgments with a frontal cortex still up and running on into the night. Arguing and unthreading the synaptic tangles of short-term memories, mindless register of every blocked limbic impulse of the tits and ass enticing day. See? Get back to the tits and ass. So he's floating above. He says, you're still awake in the astral, able to make moral judgments with the frontal cortex still up and running, with a frontal cortex still up and running on into the night. Arguing and unthreading the synaptic tangles of short-term memories, mindless register of every blocked limbic impulse of the tits and ass enticing day. What divine or demonic force is sucking your soul up out of your flaccid body, you can't know in a mind that is not one or the other. And so you reject the wind and pronounce hard judgment. Then...